Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, Gary.
Hello, Guy.
How are you?
Well, having just seen you at breakfast,
I was going to say, have you changed since anything drastic happened since breakfast?
So we are in Porto, in Portugal, and it's
very beautiful.
Fabulous.
Porto, yeah, it's a wonderful, wonderful old city.
Yeah, I spent the whole day yesterday just wandering the old town up and down hills, down dales, and fantastic cafes and shops, and really a different way of building architecture. It reminded me of Brazil, and of course that.
Oh, yeah, that's where this comes from. But yeah, and there's something quite sort of fantastical about a lot of it, quite fabulistic. It's almost like being in a sort of Neil Gaiman sort of world or something.
I think we're almost at the end, aren't we? This is the last one of our season. We're going to take a break after this. And have a holiday,
yeah, because we've been on tour for... it seems like forever now. It has been very long. Yes. And it's been fantastically rewarding, but very hard work keeping this going throughout. I'm very pleased we did.
We've managed 12 episodes while being on the road.
Yeah.
Which is pretty good.
Bully for us. But anyway, this week, Serge Pisano.
Yes. And really, I have gone into this guy's work and I have to hold my hand up and say I have underestimated Kasabian for a long time. The work is fantastic. This album in particular, now he's stepped up and become the front man. You know, we should mention that obviously there's been issues and Tom Meehan was fired from the band a couple of years ago, and quite big issues. Serge and the boys were not sure what to do for a while, and now he's taken over as lead vocalist. And I think it's been the right thing to do, listening to this record.
It's been absolutely the right thing to do. But interesting, I mean, because looking back, seeing as how he was, you know, he wrote it all. He was always singing on everything. But, anyway, let's save this for him. Let's get him on.
Okay. Welcome to the Rock On Tours.
Okay, guys, I'm ready.
But it's a big tune for sure. I actually wrote that originally for Tina Turner.
Of course, I had gone and found Joni Mitchell down in Florida and brought her back.
I've listened to a few of them and they've been really good, man. I'm sitting in the back of the car coming into London. They're brilliant.
Thank you guys for still being around, still making music, still being into it and doing this podcast. It's fabulous.
So great to talk to two guys that have done this.
Remember me? I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music.
You know this thing about the 10,000 hours of experience?
Oh, yeah.
Get good at something. When we recorded Arnold Lane, we'd done about 50 hours.
The Rock On Tours podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt.
Serge.
Hey, mate.
Hey.
How's it going?
Good. Do you think we could see you?
Yes, of course. There. Sorry, man.
That'd be cool.
I was just on the phone. Let me see how far. I'm sorry, man. I'm so bad at this. Oh, okay. Oh, there we go.
Yay! There it is.
I don't get on well with the Zoom thing. I like to see people. I'm not. I apologise already. I mean, we're not started yet, but I like people's faces, and I get, you know what I mean. This Zoom thing.
No. I heard you say on another interview how you had the Zoom turned off because you didn't like it. But it's all right. It's just nice for communication.
Yeah, no, it's cool. No. Do you know what that was? Because my internet, where I live, my internet's so bad, and it was just kept turning off. So.
Yeah. I love what you're wearing. This is so, you know, one of the things looking at researching you, you know, looking at the pitch, what you wore at the Isle of Wight, it was fantastic. I mean, style is such a massive thing for you, isn't it, Serge?
Yeah. Now being the front man as well, it's a heavy job, man. Like, it's heavy lift. Like, I was sort of, you know, pipe and slippers, I sort of been saying. But once you step into that role, it's like, it's serious. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's a different thing. So
yeah.
The kind of style thing for me, that's my playtime. It's like, okay, well, this is where I can have a bit of fun. You know, I mean, this is the bit I'm into where I can go, right, to take my mind off the gig. It's like, right, need a serious outfit. This is going out on telly.
Yeah.
Need to make sure everyone at home goes, what is this he's got on today? You know what I mean? And I think that's kind of like a little bit of, I don't know, I suppose it's a bit of relief or release, do you know what I mean? To just go, you know, and I think of all the great, like I always think of all the amazing shows and amazing gigs and amazing bands and artists out there that have just worn outfits, and you in my mind they're just ingrained, you know what I mean? They're just like
Bowie, Bowie, right?
Yeah,
Prince.
Exactly that. And
Tyler the Creator at the moment. My kids and I agree. Tyler the Creator's clothes, unbelievable.
He's up there as like, you know, like him and Kendrick, they're like unique, once in a generation artists. Tyler's live show as well.
Yeah.
I mean, everything. And what it is with him, you know, is that detail. It's just everything is considered. And, that, you know, I think that's, for me, so important. Like when talking about style, because it can just be like throwaway. Oh, yeah, it's just, you know, showing off in clothes, which it is, that's for sure. But the shoelace, with Tyler, there's everything, you know, and that's, for me, like, that's exactly the same. And it goes down to, you know, like, even the picks have to be right. You know, everything has to, you know, everything has to be fine detail considered. Because I really enjoy that part of it. But that goes in the songwriting, that goes in the live show, the songwriting. You know, everything. Jack White's the same. Like, if you watch anything he does, you know, it's like that attention to detail is just so vital.
That's brilliant, because so many people don't. Because, I mean, we, you know, because Gary and I are on tour together and we front this band, again, which is something that's new for us, even though the drummer is really the guy who sells the tickets. But it's that same thing of having to sort of dress up and express yourself a bit. I mean, I did a post on Facebook a while ago saying I'm just so bored of going to see bands who look like they've come to fix your boiler or do your VAT.
Yeah. I mean, but then again, that is like, that's cool. If that's your thing and that's who you are, I'm into that as well. Like, you know, like, cause you say that about Nirvana, you say that Kurt, you know, which weirdly now is everyone wants to look like that, but he was just going in thrift stores or whatever.
Yeah, but that changed the world. He changed the world.
Because that
was such a statement.
Yes, totally. Exactly. And he was reacting against, you know, the sort of, the hair bands and all that, but even so, like, you know, he knew what card
exactly.
he knew those massive t-shirts, and it is that thing of like, you're right, it's that thing of, you can see when someone's forgot and it's like, come on, like, this isn't, you know, show me something, you know, but I want to be amazed, you know, I want to be sort of, I want my mind to be blown, you know. And I think that's David Byrne's an interesting one, because he dressed like he wanted to, you know, he dressed like he saw people in the street going to work on Wall Street. And it's like, that's quite an interesting move.
Yeah, that's interesting, because that there's an element of commentary in that. And I do get a feeling with you that obviously there's complete theatre in what you do. And at times, I'm never quite sure whether you're having me on or not. You know, there's that sense of humour. You mentioned Viv Stanshaw in one of your interviews. You know, that the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band. That element of performance art, which is kind of what you, especially in Kasabian, have always tried to achieve.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the fun element as well, because it's that, you know, what you do really is ridiculous. It's ridiculous. So it's sort of accepting that, but then also using that as a kind of, I mean, sometimes probably you would kind of use it as a, it's a good defense mechanism, you know, where you can go, oh, I was only messing around, and you know what I mean? But I do think, I don't know, to laugh and to have, you know, just pure fun and jokes with the band and with your fans.
Well, I think like a great example would be the video for You're in Love with a Psycho. It was fantastic. And you got Stephen Graham in it. But that's also, because I remember someone playing that to me who wasn't even necessarily interested in music. They're saying, you've got to see this video. It's so great.
Yeah. And that's funny. That's the funny title. That was one of them like beauty nuggets where I'm sure, like, you know exactly what I'm talking about, when it's like 9 times out of 10, a song is torture, isn't it? You know, like, it's like, oh, You might get, might be lucky and get a little chorus or a little intro or something, and for 20 minutes is the best day of your, you know, of your life, because you go, I've got it, and then it's like, ah, I can't get it, and it's good. I know this riff's good, but it's just, yeah, this is going nowhere. And then eventually you get there. With that song, I had the title, and it made, you know, it sort of made me laugh. I thought, well, this is quite interesting. And then it 10 minutes later, it just wrote itself, and it's those days.
Yeah.
That's the reason why they're the days that, you know, that one day in 10 years.
I think what I was talking about is there's always been a sense of postmodernism about Kasabian and about your work, in that you know, in the old days, I talk about the 80s and the 70s, there was a real sense of tribalism. You played this music and you stayed in that world, you know. You didn't confuse people. You were a rock act, you were a dance act, you punk, whatever, indie. But there's a sense with what you guys do, coming late to the game, I guess, starting in the 2000s, when there was much more access to archive and everything on the internet growing, which there wasn't for me and Guy starting out. You know, that's sort of like sticking different elements of music together, different performances together. That's kind of what I was talking about the theatre of what Kasabian do.
Mm. Yeah. That's spot on. That's a perfect observation, because my first musical instrument was an Akai sampler, and
which is amazing. That's so fantastic. My first musical instrument was a sampler. I mean, that's
really fantastic.
Yeah. Exactly. But that means you start with the global view, which is I have to learn how to use everything.
definitely. And then everything is sort of up in the air in terms of an influence. So, you know, with the decks I had, like I had my parents' record collection, sisters, and then I had my own, because they were the records in the house. So I would, you know, I'd mix sort of Sergeant Pepper's in with a sort of rave track, and you know, I would never could quite get it. There's the kind of first moment, and then wanting to sort of try and make it yourself, you know. But looking back now, thinking about it, that definitely, you know, I don't think I've moved on much from there, trying to sort of, you know, blend Sergeant Pepper's with a sort of, you know, right, with a rave tune. I think that's kind of pretty much just the line.
Your yardstick for your entire career is Sergeant Pepper's and a rave tune.
Serge, I connected with elements of this, though, because, you know, growing up as I was into prog in the beginning, I was into punk in the middle 70s, and then I was into soul music and dance. And part of what I was doing in Spandau Ballet was mixing dance and rock putting all those influences together. And it seems to me that, you know, you coming out of all the influences of hip hop and jungle and then suddenly crashing into the whole Oasis scene that was happening in 95, but you had the skill to bring all those art forms onto the decks.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. That's it. That's it.
And synthesizers.
And I think which is another, you know, that's the sort of that's the nerd part of my personality comes through there. Is anything with anything that's got wood on the side, I'm in.
Where did that start?
it was kind of like late 90s. The Warp label. I was kind of obsessed with anything that came from that. So, you know, like Boards of Canada and Aphex Twin and or Tetra. So I kind of got into all that, and then sort of trying to, because it was a lot harder to get information about how things were made and what synths they were using. Like it was kind of, you know, it was a real sort of, it was impossible. Now, you know, you only need to sort of look up and there's lists of equipment that's used on stuff, and it's the access to that stuff is great. But back then it was like, I don't even know what they were using, how they were doing it. So you pretty much had to, you know, dig deep or kind of, you know, get a computer and try and just mess around and work out, you know, how they were doing it. But when they sort of figured out that like a couple of the synths they were using, and then the kind of prog thing of sort of the Can, I was obsessed with Can as well, sort of late night.
Guy, Gary's been on a big Can. I haven't got around to it. Gary's
much deeper in than I am. I haven't really gone there yet, but yes,
can.
Yeah,
can. I mean, krautrocked it. Totally invented Baggy way before Baggy ever started. I mean, that drummer.
Honestly,
live at Manchester is unbelievable.
It is so the way they keep the groove, because obviously, you know, there's no click, they're just a band, but the groove is it's frightening. And then to capture that on tape as well, because they record so well as well, it's not like, you know, it's mind bending that they were just, you know, and now that still sounds as fresh, you know, now than you play that to any kids.
Yeah.
Vitamin C, I mean, yeah. Ridiculous.
So go on. We stopped you on your flow of discovery.
Yeah, no. That was the, you know, then I just sort of look at take photos and then just try and work out what synths they were using. And then it was just a matter of going on eBay. But you could get them really cheaply then. It's insanely expensive now. But back then, you could sort of pick up mad synths. And then a few like...
you're talking about like the 70s ones, the old...
The 70s ones, like the Pro One and the 2600 and, you know, and then all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I had a friend who recently soldered, like the JV 10-8, whatever, the Roland, which was the absolute cheapest, really workhorse synth that everyone had in the 80s. And he just sold one for like 10 grand.
I'm not surprised. Honestly, you could get away. Those horrible sounds that... I mean, it's a bit like the Shell suit when everyone went, no one's ever going to wear them again. Do you know what I mean? It's like everyone's in Reebok Shell suits now, thinking, how did they come back? But it's the same with those.
Keep everything.
It's like 80 synths with the cheapest sounds, and you're like, I remember hearing them going, oh, no, there's no way. But then now it's like you hear on most records now, they've got that sound.
And was rave your punk?
Exactly that. It's a great question, because it's like that was the kind of I want to get into music, and I'd sort of, you know, found a, like you said, a tribe, and I was into the, like, with the rave scene, it was like that the gathering and the fact that it was all underground, so you couldn't go to the records, you know, HMV didn't sell it. There was a store in Leicester that you know, I used to get my dad to get the flyers, do you know what I mean? Because they wouldn't give it underage kids, do you know what I mean? So my mum was like, what are these bits of paper I'm getting? I'd like a bedroom full of flyers and stuff. But I think that was the thing that sparked this, like, music and making music and the means to make it. If you had a computer, you could do it all yourself. You didn't have to go to the studio. And so that was all amazing. But then I was a sort of perfect age for the rise of, you know, I don't really like calling it Britpop because I had Jarvis Cocker recently. Like, he won't use the word Brit, you know what I mean? It sort of offends him so much because he was like, oh, we were more than that. But it was that thing of seeing Oasis and seeing, you know, like lads that are into football that play guitars. And it just hit on me and all my friends because we were Leicester boys, you know what I mean? Like, it's all that sort of, we were the perfect kind of, like, we were just there right for that kind of world. And then once I got a guitar and learned a few tracks, Oasis tracks, then it was like, oh, there's all this, the Beatles and the Doors and Jimi Hendrix and the Who. And I just went, that was the next phase of, like, obsession.
That was an extraordinary moment. We were talking to Noel. Noel's been on the show, and we know Noel quite well. But it was that moment when they did Nebworth, and it happened so soon in their career. This is what's extraordinary.
Yeah.
This is a cultural moment of mostly white lads, right? Where that band was in the audience just like a year before. And now they're on stage, they're not skilled musicians, they're writing euphoric songs, and it's that easy. Was there, where punk was like, oh, it's that easy for me to form a band, but only play the marquee. For your generation, it was like, oh, it's easy to play a stadium.
You know what, that's spot on, because I, you know, when people sort of talk about that, the confidence, where did it come from, or, you know, why, you know, it's that generation that like you said, it was, you don't aim for like, we didn't, we, when we got signed, we didn't aim for, oh, we want to make a record and, you know, we want, we're so happy to be here. We were like, we want to play Wembley Stadium. We want to play it on the, you know, we, that's by the third record. If we're not there, we've not done what we should, we set out to do, you know. And thinking about it now, it's complete madness, you know. Because it's just, you just, you know, you're sort of blessed to be just able to make tunes and, you know, but back then it was like, no, you know, surely this, it's about getting to play, do our version of Nebworth, you know. And that's a great thing, because it was the belief that in these dirty little rehearsal rooms with carpet on the wall, and we was, it was always like, imagining how big we could get it and how quick and fast we could get there. Do you know what I mean?
And what, but was that your first shot? I mean, was Kasabian, was that the first bunch of mates you got together with, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. And then, you know, but I think that's kind of, yeah, the sort of beginning of you know, how it all sort of came to be.
But where did you meet Tom and Christopher, and were you just all mates first, or
just mates at school? Yeah, all mates at school, and you know, into the same things, as you say, like, you know.
Yeah. And was it like, were you all playing instruments, or was it decided, okay, we're going to be a band, you're playing bass?
Yeah, exactly that. It was who you could afford, right. Whatever you could afford. You know, if you could afford a bass, then that's what you played. And I was, because I always wanted to. I loved writing songs. Songwriting was my thing. That was like the thing I'd fallen in love with from the age of like 12, even though I didn't know it then, just making beats and trying to, you know, play people. I'd record stuff on tape and show it. And I didn't even realize, but so I was like, obviously I'll be the Noel Gallagher thing, you know, I'll be Pete Townsend.
Well, I guess if you started with a sampler, then you kind of, you've basically started as a producer from the world go, really, haven't you?
No, that's exactly. I think that's one of the advantages that we had, because that's how I always knew, that's how I'd always made, because I started there by making music on myself in a bedroom, and that's not changed. That's exactly how it is now. The bedroom's, you know, probably a bit, it's a studio now, but it's the same thing, essentially. The advantage we had over everyone else starting from that same point was that Oasis were great, but the Prodigy and the Chemical Brothers were as important, and you know, the whole hip hop scene with how they made and got music together. So it was like, well, okay, what's great about Britpop Oasis is getting people together and having that euphoric music. But then what's great about having a computer and making it all yourself is you don't have to sit in a room, rehearse, get everyone up to speed. You're going to sound like a band, which is great. And if the songs are good, then you're cool. But if you want to come at it from a different angle, then, you know, what does it sound like if DJ Muggs or Dr. Dre produced the Rolling Stones you know, or The Who? It's, you know, like, that's the thing we have.
I want to talk to you about that trade-off that you must have to make as a songwriter, producer who puts down beats, and then you have a drummer in the band. But we'll talk about that when we get to the new album, mm-hmm. which is absolutely brilliant, by the way. And I think it's your best work.
Thank you so much.
But was there a frustration with you? Because I think, you know, you kind of got underrated, I'd say, even by me, right? And I'm being honest here, because of the lumping in with Oasis. But your music had much, much more depth. You know, God love Noel and Liam, but had much more depth as musically than anything Oasis were doing. In fact, the only thing you probably had in common was that sort of euphoric swagger on stage. Did it frustrate you?
It's always been an interesting one, that, because it's almost like you sort of, you can't really do anything about it. And I figured that out pretty quickly. The critics were, once they assign you to, you know, that's what you are, it's really difficult ever to change. Like it's really difficult to kind of it takes a long time for people to sort of, you know, you have to release a lot of music and do a lot of crazy things. But even then, when we did mad stuff and left field stuff, it still get boiled down to lad rock, and it would amaze me. But then again, it would also kind of give us, like, I don't know, like, to be written off and to be sort of underestimated, I think keeps you creatively as an artist, it gives you that little bit of edge that I think's pretty important, because, you know, you can get comfortable, and if everyone understands, like, part of being a songwriter and part of being in a band is you kind of, no one understands you. So you kind of, you know what I mean? When you're first in a kid and you want to be in a band, it's like, fuck everyone, man. This is just us and no one gets us and we don't give a shit about what anyone thinks and what anyone says and this is our thing. So if that carries on, sometimes, you know, that's probably not a bad thing, because it does keep you hungry and it does keep you in the studio.
Thank God, they still don't understand. No, but yeah, the thing is, because you did have that swagger and that brilliant stadium sort of certainty that Oasis and everyone had, but there are, do you think your audience, never mind the critics, your audience were pinging on the fact that you're always clearly, unlike them, very, very self-aware and kind of had all sorts of wit and irony going on within your stuff. So sure, your audience must have been getting that rather than just the kind of...
Yes, yes, definitely, definitely. And I think it's also kept the relationship, like, with our fans and stuff. It's been beautiful, because, you know, it's like being into something that, say, everyone doesn't get. That's also a nice thing. I like that myself, you know. It's like, if you like a director, a certain director, like Pasolini or something, people die, you can say, and they go, oh, I'm not sure, oh, that's terrible, or you know, I didn't even understand what he's doing, or Jodorowsky or whatever. But then you go, well, I love him. And if you don't understand it, then you don't know it. You know what I mean? You sort of get that with the fans where they go, well, you can't hear it, you know?
Yeah, it's also a nice way of very sort of subtly letting us know that you're seriously up on your art house directors.
Oh, that was, did you get that one?
Actually,
things I've written down going, right, if I get these things, I'm going to sound clever.
It's all part of a bet.
But I get that, especially on your solo album, the cinematic stuff going on. You know, the Morricone vibe that's in there. I mean, there's elements of John Barry on the new album that you can hear, obviously. And it did occur to me that the way you talk about your records, that sort of conceptually, if you, Serge, have a kind of cinema version of your life that goes on permanently in your head that you're trying to soundtrack, is that possible?
Yeah, I think that is, because, like, I struggle with sort of, like, I'm dyslexic, so I'm struggle with sort of words sometimes.
So many songwriters are.
Yeah. So visually, for me, imagery is so powerful, and it's how I remember things. It's how I kind of find some grounding in it all. So I think it relates to that, why cinema and film and how the music always makes you, it's always very visual, and the words are always very visual as well, not so much kind of like really direct sentiment, whereas I'll find things more in kind of sort of imagery and like how it hits you emotionally, how it makes you feel, rather than exactly what it's saying. I mean, so I think that the cinema is really important.
Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
This episode of Rock on Tours is sponsored by AG1, the daily nutrition supplement.
AG1 is a comprehensive and convenient blend of over 70 vitamins, minerals, and other vital ingredients like gut-friendly bacteria, antioxidants, and much more.
Just one scoop of AG1 daily has all the nutrients you need to support your mental performance, energy levels, heart health, and immune system.
To be honest, it's pretty vital stuff for us, because when you've got a life on the road and you're short of time, or you're too busy to plan and prepare healthy meals, you're getting your podcast together, you're being shouted at, and it's just a nightmare, AG1 gives me all the good stuff and helps keep my energy levels where I need, ready for showtime or doing the podcast, and with a nice vanilla taste.
It keeps me focused, feeling good, feeling healthy with its daily dose of vitamin C and zinc. And it's so easy to use. Just one scoop a day gives me over 70 carefully selected ingredients. Simple.
Trusted by Olympians, F1 drivers and the rock on tours. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and a free 1 year supply of vitamin D and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription.
Go to drinkag1.com/rockonteurs. That's drinkag1.com/rockonteurs. Check it out.
Funny, okay, on a slightly more prosaic but cinema-related thing, what's interesting is the fact that, because I have a very dear old friend, Gary Knows, who's always spoken very highly of you, who's Stephen McLaughlin.
Yeah.
Oh, right, yes.
And who mainly works in cinema as an engineer and producer. And in fact, I got in touch with him. I said, listen, because he's always gone about how great you are. And I sent him a message saying, we're talking to you. I'd love to get a quote off you. Well, unfortunately, he's laid up in bed with COVID.
Yes. No, he's not good.
He's an engineer.
I just wonder if the fact that he's engineered and mixed for you, but the fact that he's used to doing music for picture. You know,
that's right, yeah.
If anyway yeah. feeds your cinematic... You know,
so I scored a film called London Boulevard, and that's where I met Steve. Right. He was the studio. They needed a sort of, as they put it, they needed a grown up. I mean, they didn't tell me this, but then I figured out that's what they call people like that. They need a grown up, someone in the room that's done it before and knows exactly how to get these things, you know, because it's quite a big process to, you know, scoring a film. Yeah, but that's where I met Steve. But I love that so much, and it felt so natural to just be sat in front of a picture and go, right, you know, what we need some music. But I did thinking back, I didn't really know what I was doing, so it was way weirder than it should have been. The score is bizarre, but I don't really know what I was doing.
I met Steve because he was the engineer for Michael Kamen, who did the soundtrack for the Craze movie.
That's right, yeah.
This is something that, this made me think about something that I wanted to ask you, which is you began as a band in a world that was not as simple as mine. You know, we made records for vinyl mostly, and we'd also make videos. You're in a place where streaming has already begun, where CDs, you can have 20, 30 tracks on a CD. There's no sense of focus about an album in the same way there was. But you've also got to promote it in a million different ways. You know, there's this idea of music for games, music for TV, for adverts. That seems to me like really difficult to focus on where the energy of a record is when you've got to promote it in all those different ways.
Yeah. In a way, I think, for good or for bad, I'm a real true believer in an album as an art form, as in, you know, in the ones that I grew up listening to, and in that classic format, you know, like a OK Computer or a Peppers or the ones that we all know and love. So I still approach the record making process in that way.
Do you end side one?
Every time, yeah. I've got a whiteboard that's just constant, like, you know, one of those kind of, you know, the things that, so I'm just constantly, and that's more important, you know, a lot of the time. I think it also helps you, gives you a sort of like, so it gives you a box to make everything fit. Cause if you've got, this could be anything, then I don't know what I'd rather just go down.
In fact, you called one of your albums the time of it, 48 minutes.
48, which 13.
Exactly.
Telling people that's what you got to listen to, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Because you do follow that thing of the album as statement, don't you? Is that you make a point, you do that lovely thing of it's like the band growth. Every album has to have moved on to somewhere else from the last one.
Exactly. And it's, you know, I don't really think about algorithms, and I don't think about, you know, how it's going to stream or what's this going to be like. which is probably crazy because I think, you know, the format, everything about music as I see it, is completely new and changed. So maybe down the line, you know, I may think about things differently, but I don't know. It's almost like going to see a sculpture or something, or going to see a painting, or having an NFT. You know what I mean? I'm like, for me, the album is like, you go to the gallery and you're in awe of this thing that you're stood in front of. And I feel like that's the album still for me. You know, having it on your phone and flicking through it and not really just, it's great. And it, you know, it's a different thing. For me, it's a different thing.
Because the artwork's always been important for you too, isn't it?
Yeah, it's always been, it's like having the language that you know, that period of time where that album was made, you know, like the font or a symbol or, you know, you'll know exactly where the band were at that point. Do you know what I mean? That's like mm-hmm. It's a world that was created.
Well, it used to be that everything was significant. Every piece of text was significant. You know, who am I?
Absolutely.
Where am I? You know.
Absolutely. And you would, that was a big thing about what studios recorded. And because we didn't really know anything about, that were the only little bits of information you could get hold of knowing about a band. Whereas now, you know, why the album's being made, you can get videos of them in the studio having, you know, a Deliveroo, you know what I mean? It's like,
Does it annoy you? I mean, and it infuriates me. The thing is that you can find every bit of information about an album, but none of it is with the album. When you go and look at it
on
Spotify or on Apple Music or wherever, there's nothing there.
It drives me crazy.
No.
Yeah.
No, me.
Serge, you know, your story, I mean, it is like a film. And I mean, it has, obviously there's a tragic element to your success, you know, recently, but it is mm-hmm. this boy, you know, who starts off co-writing with a friend as the sort of sideman in the band in a way, visually, who ends up becoming the main songwriter, the producer, and eventually through circumstance, the singer. I mean, it's a star is born completely. That first initial bit though, when Christopher Karloff left the band and you then had to take on that role yourself as a solo songwriter. I mean, now I guess it's tough for you to write songs with anyone else, isn't it? Other than on your own.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose
that's scary for you.
No, I mean, do you know what, that I suppose, because those tunes were, you know, that first record, like I wrote all the songs in terms of the acoustic, the melody, the lyric. So I knew exactly what was going on there. You know, Chris offered the more landscapey, you know, that kind of world. But in terms of, you know, the bare bones of getting us, you know, waking up in the morning and going, right, we need a tune, you know, that started when I was sort of 15, and that started when the band's, you know, the inception of the band is like, you know, like LSF, you know, that's the guitar. And that's just, you know, waking up one morning going, one of those beautiful moments, that was one of those songs where it just wrote itself. So it was just a matter of, I don't know,
it's natural.
Single vision. It's natural. And also the single vision of going, right, problem solving, what needs to happen? Right, this is what needs to happen. Well, let's just get it done then. Do you know what I mean? Don't overthink it. The course of this band is not being moved, or nothing's going to get in the way of where we're going to get to. So however we get there, you just figure it out. And so from early on, that's always been the case. So, you know, moving to become the singer, because these words, these lyrics, they're ingrained in my soul, you know, like, because I penned every single one of them and I know where I was and where my head was with it. I think that's why it was always the decision that, you know, if we were going to carry on rather than getting someone else to sing, it's just like, well, that would be fine, but no one's going to connect with them like I can, because they're from that beating heart, you know, and the pain and the joy that comes from within. So on stage, whatever you feel about the show, one thing's for sure, you'll know I mean it. You'll know You know, yeah.
It's like when Townsend. It's like when Townsend sings Who songs. It's kind of
It's exactly that. I mean, but you've sung on every album, I think. You know, I mean, songs like, I love the way you, your say British Legion on Empire. That reminds me of like when Ronnie Lane did Debris on Not As Good As A Wing. Yeah,
how did you know, or
how did you say to Tom, this one's for me, not for you, mate?
Usually it was the sort of more delicate ones and the softer ones. And it sort of made sense, you know? It was like, oh, I'd come in with that one and it's like, you know what, that sounds great, let's just leave it as it is. Rather than replace the vocal.
But when it comes to being the front man, stepping out and doing that, especially as we talked about theatre, and that's the fact that sometimes you lose your greatest prop, which is the guitar. How does that feel?
Yeah, I mean, again.
Your guitar really interests me, by the way, because it's like a Rickenbacker 4001 bass, but it's a guitar.
Yes, yeah, the side fret. Yes, a beauty. Yeah. 481, I think they're called.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a great find. You need a signature guitar. And it's like, right, I think, you know, and this, it's hard to find one now, you know, because everyone's used whatever, but that's a beauty. I think, I mean, again, it's a bit like, you know, we thought it was all, we could, you know, it could be all over. And it was the most horrendous time of our lives, heartbreaking. But it came from, you know, necessity of just going, well, you've got to get up there and do it. So with that in mind, you know, you get your parachute on and you jump out of the plane and, you know, hopefully someone's packed a parachute. Do you know what I mean? And I think that's how I started with just, I decided no inhibitions. And I didn't want to just go on stage and just feel it. Like in the way in which I'm in a studio and I'm, usually I'll have a beat going or a loop going. I'll just leave the mic on and record just to see what's the first thing that comes out. It's usually pretty good. And then the longer it goes on, it gets worse. But so it's just like, and it's like, so I thought that's how I'm going to attack the front man. It's like, just feel every beat, feel every note, and whatever that does to my body, whatever that does, just go with that vibe. And also connect the crowds, like, as in just be an extension of that energy that's being thrown at you. It's like suck that energy in and then spit it out, as you know. And I think that was the vibe. And that's when I put the guitar down, and it's a lot of fun, you know, it's nice. And I feel like I'm really just getting started where I can get to the point where I can hold a stage and,
well, they're big stages. You know. You on straight to big stages, haven't you? No.
Yeah, Nebworth was interesting. I mean, it was like the second. I think that was the second outdoor show, and I was like, Jesus, man! If we get through this, and I can, you know, then anything else after that will be pretty good.
Well, my son actually posted a clip of you at the Isle of Wight on Instagram. He was loving it that much. So there you go.
Oh, that's amazing! Thank you.
It's a bit of a coincidence because. At breakfast this morning, John Giddings walks in. We're in Portugal, by the way. We're in Porto. And John Giddings runs the Isle of Wight, right?
So, yeah, yeah.
And he's our agent, and he's come over. And the first thing, I said, we've got Serge on. He said, oh, tell him, it was fantastic at the Isle of Wight. He did an amazing job.
That's beautiful.
But Serge, you know, when all the stuff went down with Tom and you made the choice to get rid of him, and I'm sure... 100%. There were other issues that went that the news didn't know about that maybe this was the thing that finally broke it for you. But that collapse of your, not just of a band, but potentially of your legacy, you know, not getting played on the radio, maybe, you know, mm-hmm. I mean to come out of that with such strong creativity that you've just achieved. It's extraordinary. Did you go into the studio to heal yourself, or did you go in with the ambition of making a Kasabian record?
I think both. I think both for sure, because I probably all know that like music can be such a therapeutic thing, and it's a way of dealing, especially I've used it to deal with a lot of my issues and a lot of just, you know, I don't know where I'd be without it. So it was like getting the studio as a sanctuary and try and make sense of it all, try and make a beautiful Kasabian album, and, you know, in a sort of turn a shit situation into a beautiful one, you know, in a way.
Was there a moment?
And so, that was the plan.
Was there a moment when you went, I'm not giving up on this? Do you remember that moment?
I think, yes. We sat down with Ian and Chris, and the thought of it ending like that and the story ending there, just we just couldn't let it happen, you know. And it's one of those things, bands, and the, you know, it runs deep, and but for the respect of everyone, you know, we've kept it in-house, you know. But in terms of us moving forward, we looked at each other and said, there's no way we can let it end like that. We have to just, there has to be another chapter or another part to this whole story. And from then on, then let's see what happens, you know, let's see where this takes us. And then it's, you know, after a while and the music's starting to sound good, it gets exciting again. And it's been hard. It's been really hard.
But it must be brilliant to know that you're in charge of your narrative again. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
You've taken hold of the story and you're moving the story along, not events.
Absolutely, absolutely. Because, you know, it's your life's work. And, like, you guys know better than anyone that, you know, you've created this thing and it literally could, to see it, like, go up in flames and just be like, oh, I don't know, what now? What? You know, I can't even tell you. But then, you know, slowly but surely, playing these shows and you know, making this record, it's starting to feel great again. And not only that, it's starting to feel really exciting because the reaction's been phenomenal. And I've really, you know, this is us just getting started.
Was there a sense of freedom in knowing that you were writing for yourself though now? That there was not another person in the room that you had to be the medium between you and the audience.
I think this album, you know, I think this is the next phase of, because each album has been a reaction to the last. So I think the course in terms of the creativity and the way the albums, the music's gone, that was always going to go where it's got to. I think there's a speed within the studio, and there's a I can react a lot quicker to situations where I can just experiment with range of vocal. I can, you know, and in different character, you know, get in front of the mic and, you know, I can physically change my body and the way I'm singing, and things like that are really exciting, which are really hard to kind of get across when someone else is singing your words.
I guess coming back to Gareth's point, are you aware of that when you're writing, thinking that it's now me that's conveying it?
I think so. I mean, I don't feel like I'm doing anything that differently in terms of the way I'm recording or writing. But definitely now I can sort of see the sense of, all right, when I'm going to perform this song, you know, I can see the whole stage show and I can see the whole performance, you know, which is something that I couldn't before, which I think is a massive sort of, which makes things really interesting.
I love
the band's live.
I think that thing you said earlier about changing characters within a song, that really comes across on this record. It's always been in your music. If you look at something like Fire, you know, that starts like a Doors track, then it goes into kind of like a disco thing, then it has an acid house moment, you know, and the vocal and your voice sometimes can be screaming through a megaphone and then suddenly go sweet with harmonies, which makes me think, actually, you are closer to prog music than you know.
No, I'm
Yeah, we wanted
I'm
to get huge, to that.
Yes.
Yeah, especially there's one track on the new album. It's got two different titles on the two different versions, TUE or TUV.
The Ultraview Effect. Yeah. Which it's pure prog. That is pure prog.
There's some chords which are quite redolent of a thing we play every night, actually, which is Atom Heart Mother. Which is beautiful.
Amazing. Yeah. No, that tune. That's the real centerpiece of the album.
Ah, it's an incredible piece.
It's fantastic.
Yeah, and it's really exciting. I think, like, you know, because it's got that almost like Mamas and Papas like harmonies at the start, and then it goes into kind of like a sort of, you know, the Warp or Tetra Kid A kind of middle section, and then out into it's sort of Floyd, and then he sort of scoops on that like sort of late 70s like Italian cinema a bit as well. Glad you like that.
A lot of your songwriting is you write a song kind of like people would write it's more like a suite, then, isn't it? We're going to be here, they're going to take you here, they're going to take you there.
Tarantino, I mean, like, I always, he's a massive influence because, like, the way how he slips through each genre, like in Kill Bill, each character in that is its own subgenre of a film. So, you know, I always thought that was a really clever way of making something familiar, but then making something super modern and like a real clever twist. Because I love the 60s, but the idea of making a song that sounds like the 60s, I don't know, it feels a bit like one of those reenactment things where you go, you know, you dress up as like
Civil War,
you know, like,
really?
Civil War thing. You know what I mean? It's like not into that. But the idea of making, like, you know, a 60s song using the technology we have now and the mindset, like, you know, what would Tyler the Creator sound like if you produced the Monkees or something? It's like, yeah, now we're starting to get somewhere. Now we're getting somewhere.
But like Scripture that's on the new album, you know, there's a kind of mashup sort of that goes between sort of Chili Peppers and King Crimson, you know. And
yes,
but I always get the feeling that with your songs, you're in a room and you go, oh, just see what's in this door. And you open this door and a chorus comes out. You open this door and a middle eight comes out, you know. This is why I kind of get upset when you get pushed into that Lad Rock Oasis thing, because you are doing stuff that is really in the same way that Kendrick does, you know, and pushing the boundaries of where music can go and should go, but at the same time hitting all the euphoric hooks that you need to find in a record to make it exciting.
Yeah.
That's not a question. That's just praise, right?
No, thank you. That's so beautiful, sir. I really appreciate that so much, because, you know, that's been the mission from the start.
What about comedy? What about Noel? How does this happen in your life? Where does it all sort of fit in?
It was the Isle of Wight. It was in maybe 2008, maybe. And he was there and we just got, just instantly just gravitated and got on.
Sorry. Can I just say, when I said comedy and Noel, I didn't mean Gallagher. I meant Fielding, right?
You meant Fielding, right? I've got you. We met Isle of Wight and stayed up for a few days together, just talking madness, and we're into the similar stuff. And I've always been a massive, massive comedy fan. Stand-up, man, the respect I have for a stand-up, especially even more so now.
Thank you. I've done it for 15 years.
And even more so now. You know, I have way more respect for singers now and frontmen than I ever have done as well. But stand-up, man, like, just you there with a mic delivering and not relying on past. That's the thing with music and stuff. It's like, oh, you know, it's not going very well. You know, play a few, they know it's going to be fine. Whereas comedy, it's like, you've had your year at that set, right? Give us something new. And if you told that joke before, no one's laughing. It's like, oh, that's horrendous.
Well, what's funny, when I started doing it, Serge, is that after years and years of people just going, oh, you're a musician, oh, you're so lucky to do something you love, oh, how great to do something you love, oh, you're doing something you love, oh, how brilliant you do something you love, and the guy do stand-up, you're so brave! You're so brave! It's like, well, it's still the same self-serving, insecure thing. I haven't become a fireman.
Yeah, true. You're right. No, you're right. But I do buzz off.
But that little marriage you have with Noel, that kind of makes us, that's the bit that I was talking about earlier about the postmodern thing. It makes us kind of think, you know, is there a tongue in Serge's cheek at times, you know?
Yes, massively.
Yeah.
I think, like, it's born in us to be, you know, piss takers, isn't it? I mean, coming from this land, you know, you can't take things too seriously.
It's an English thing. Americans have trouble certainly with it often, yeah.
They do. And, like, you know, if you can't, you have to see everything. You have to see that angle, you know. You have to see the ridiculous. You have to see it. And when we hang, it's just laugh. Like, that, it is like therapy, man. You know, you get those, you're just like in this little thing together where you're just laughing, dying, you know.
We've got two of his paintings, by the way. He did a whole...
Oh, man. You know what? Well,
they're brilliant. They're absolutely mad.
He's like, you know, and I think... honestly, like, I know I'm always going to say this, but I don't think there's anyone out there like as good at what he's doing now. Like, he's getting into that mastery level, and I think if he wasn't known for what he's known, I think he'd be, you know, way bigger, like taken, you know, as seriously as the greats, because he's unbelievable, and he's just constantly working and constantly trying to get better, which is. Yeah. You know, massive.
So what's next? You're out on tour with this.
Yeah, so we've got Benicassim on Sunday, and then
Japan. That's right, my son's going to be there. In fact, he probably Instagram you again.
Yes, tell him to come and see us. Tell him to come and see us, man.
Are you going on tour in the UK, or is that with the album?
Yeah, we're doing, so October, November, we've got a tour in the UK. And then that's it, yeah.
Well, listen, we're in the States in October touring it with Nick Mason, but I hope that I get to see you when we come back in November. I'm hoping you're playing London.
Yes, definitely.
Mate, we're so impressed with the way this has turned out for you and your ability.
Oh, thanks so much. Thanks for having us, man. I really enjoyed this, man. It's been great.
All right, Serge, thank you so much.
Gig. Perfect. Take care, boys. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Cheers.
See you soon. Cheers.
See ya.
Bye.
Well, that was really, really good. Great, incisive questions, Gary. That was really nice. It was obviously stuff that he was very happy to talk about.
Well, yeah, I was a bit worried a couple of times. I thought, that's not really a question. You just made a statement. But I mean, as long as I could push it along a bit. I think he's so impressive as a writer.
He's so
now.
Impressive, yeah.
And
his journey's been brilliant. And it's, yeah.
Yeah. Urge people to go out and check out the new Xabian album, which I think is out August the 5th, someone tells me. Thank you to Ben, our producer.
Yeah, and thank you to everyone for listening. This is the end of the season. We're going to have a well-deserved holiday.
We are. We'll hopefully be back sometime in September.
Indeed, yeah, but back to school with the Rock On Tours.
And it's good night from me.
And it's good night from everyone.
I'm going to cry.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.